clear that if he was prepared to talk about his distress to other people, it must go very deep indeed. And he'd made no promises to Claire, only said that he might be able to forgive her if she confessed. I didn't think, knowing James, that he would have succeeded. No. Claire had everything to lose by being honest, and nothing to gain. She had two options: tell the truth and expose herself, or refuse to go along with James's plan and lose her fiancé. And then the truth would have had to come out anyway. Either way, she would be destroyed, and the image she had built up so carefully over so many years, the image of a good friend, a loving girlfriend, and a caring, honourable person, would be shattered. I know how hard it is to walk away from your past and start again, and Claire's life is happy and glittering and successful. She must have looked at all she'd done and built and won and balanced that against a lie. She could come out of this destroyed, or she could kill James and walk away a tragic and inspiringly brave widow, ready to start again. James had to die. His execution was regretful, but necessary. But mine is a punishment. It was not enough that James die. Someone must carry the can for his death. It cannot possibly be Claire's fault, even as an accident. No, someone else must be to blame. And this time, that someone is me. Why me? I almost say, but I don't, because I know. I stole her man. 10 years ago, I came between Claire Cavendish and her rightful property, stealing him out from under her nose while she was too ill to fight for what was hers. And now I have done it again, rising up from the past like a hand from the grave to come between her and James one last time. I will not leave this house now. I know that. Claire cannot afford to let me leave. My heart is beating very, very hard in my chest. So hard that I feel oddly light-headed, as if I might fall. I stand up, unsteadily, holding my cup, and I stagger and drop it. Claire reaches for it, trying to grab it before it spills, but her gloved fingers fumble on the china, and the cup slips from between her fingers and skitters across the coffee table. And as the dregs spill out across the glass top, I see the white residue at the bottom of the cup. Not sugar, that had all dissolved, but something else, something that made the tea taste even worse than usual. I understand now. I understand my light-headedness. I understand why Claire has said so much, has allowed me to get this far. And I understand... Oh, God. I understand the gloves. She looks down at the cup, and then up at me. Oops, she says, and then she smiles. Chapter 34. For a moment, I do nothing. I just stand there, staring stupidly at the cup, feeling the lethargy in my arms and legs and the swirling confusion in my head that prevented me from noticing the effects of the drug before. What are they? Painkillers? Sleeping pills? I stand there, swaying, trying to get myself together, trying to balance. And then I stumble towards the door. I am not quick. I am slow, nightmarishly slow. But as Claire leaps towards me, her battered limbs don't quite obey. Her foot catches in the rug and she comes crashing down, her hips smacking into the wickedly sharp edge of the coffee table. She gives a scream that sets the echoes in the hallway ringing and makes my already spinning head feel even stranger, and I stagger into the hallway. I am struggling with the lock of the front door, the lock that seemed so simple and straightforward just a couple of hours ago. My fingers are slipping. The lock won't turn. And then I have done it. and I am out, snapping through the flimsy police tape into the blessedly cold, fresh air. My limbs feel like rubber, and my head is sick and dizzy. But this is what I do. I run. I can do this. I take a step, and then another, and another, and another, and then the forest swallows me up. It is incredibly, indescribably dark, but I cannot stop. The air is cold in my face, and the shapes of the trees are black against black. They rear out of the chilly dark, and I dodge and weave, ducking under branches, my hands held out to protect my face. Bracken and brambles catch at my shins, ripping at the skin. But my legs are numb and cold, and I hardly feel the slashes, only the tearing thorns holding me back. It is my nightmare. Only this time it's not James I'm trying to save, it's myself. Behind me I hear the slam of a car door and an engine revving. Full beam headlights glimmer through the tree trunks, sweeping round in a great curve as the car does a slow U-turn and then begins to bump down the rutted drive. The drive goes round in long curves so as not to climb the hill too steeply. The woodland footpath is direct. If I run fast, I can do this. I can get to the road before Claire. And then what? But I cannot think about that. My breath sobs between my gritted teeth and I force my shaking muscles to work harder, faster. I just want to live. I'm gaining speed. The path runs downhill more steeply here, and my muscles aren't forcing me on now, but trying to check my headlong rush. I leap a fallen branch and a badger's set, a dark hole and the pale scattered snow. And then, with a suddenness that punches the breath out of me, I smack into a tree. I fall onto my hands and knees in the snow, my head ringing in agony. My nose is streaming blood. I can see it dripping into the snow as I pant and pant. And when I touch Nina's cardigan, the front is dark and soaked with gore. I shake my head, trying to clear the shards and sparks shooting across my vision, and the blood spatters across the clearing. I can't stop. My only chance is to get to the road before Claire can cut me off. I steady myself, one hand on the tree trunk, trying to overcome the sick dizziness, and then I begin to run again. As I run, pictures shoot through my head, sudden flashes, like a landscape illuminated by lightning. Claire, in her wellies, slipping quietly out of the house in the early morning to send those texts from my phone, from the point in the forest where reception kicked in, leaving her footsteps in the snow for me to find. Claire, waiting until Nina was safely gone and then driving off into the dark. To what? To park quietly in a lay-by and wait for James to bleed to death. Claire, her face white in the moonlight, stiff with shock, as I burst out of the forest in front of the car, screaming at her to stop, let me in. She stamped reflexively on the brakes. I scrambled into the passenger side. As I slammed the door, she glanced at me and James, both without seatbelts, and then, without trying to explain, gunned the engine and stamped on the accelerator. For a second, I didn't understand. She was steering towards the tree that loomed out of the darkness. And then I realized. I grabbed for the steering wheel, my nails in her skin, wrestling for control of the car. And there it goes blank. Oh, God. I have to get to the road before she does. If she parks across the foot of the track and cuts me off, I'm lost. Everything hurts. Jesus, everything hurts so much. But the pills that Claire gave me have one silver lining. They've taken the edge off enough to allow me to keep going, combined with my own fear and adrenaline. I want to live. I never knew how much until now. Oh, Christ, I want to live. And then suddenly, almost without realizing it, I'm at the road. The forest path spews me out onto the tarmac, so fast that I stumble, trying to slow down enough to stop myself shooting into the path of a car. I stand there, hands on my knees, gasping and panting, and trying to work out which way to go. Where is Claire? I can hear a noise, I realize, the growl of an engine as it shoots over potholes and around bends. It's not far off. She's almost at the foot of the drive. And I can't do it. I can't run anymore. I've pushed my body beyond what it can do. I have to run, or I will die. And I can't. I can't. I can barely stand, let alone put one foot in front of another. Run! I scream inside my own head. Run, you fucking waste of space! Do you want to die? Claire's car is at the road. I see the blaze of her headlights just round the bend, lighting up the night. And then there's a horrendous, screaming squeal of tires, and a bang like nothing I've ever heard. There's shrieking rubber and the screech of metal, car on car, a sound that seems to echo forever in the forest tunnel, shrill in my ears. I stand, my eyes wide with horror, staring towards the sound of the collision. And then silence. Just the hiss of a radiator venting into the night air. I cannot run any more. But I manage to walk, my legs shaking. I have lost my flip-flops and the tarmac must be cold as ice, but I can't feel anything. In the stillness, I hear the sound of sobbing gasps and the crackle of a radio. Then, with a suddenness that makes me jump and almost stumble, the trees are illuminated by a ghostly blue, flickering like flames. One more step. One more. I force myself on, round the bend, towards whatever has happened. But before I get there, I hear a voice, a shaking female voice. She's speaking into something, a phone. But as I get closer, I see it's a police radio. It's Lamar. She is standing by the open door of her police car. There is blood running down her face, black in the flashing blue lights of the emergency siren. She's speaking into the radio. Ground control, urgent message. Her voice is shaking. There's a sob in it. Request immediate assistance and an ambulance to the B4146 just outside Stainbridge. Over. She's standing there listening to the crackling reply. Roger, she says at last, and then, no, I'm not hurt, but the other driver, look, just send the ambulance and a fire crew with cutting equipment. Over. She sets the radio carefully down and then goes back to the other car. Lamar, I say, croakily, but she doesn't hear. My limbs are so heavy I don't think I can go another step. I hold myself up on a tree by the side of the road. Lamar, I manage one more time, my voice a shaking thread against the hissing of the engine and the crackle of the radio. Lamar! She turns and looks, and then at last I let my knees give way and I kneel on the cold, snow-wet tarmac, and I don't have to run any more. Nora! I hear through the fog. Nora! Christ, are you hurt? Are you hurt, Nora? But I can't find the words to reply. Lamar is running towards me, and I feel her strong hands beneath my armpits as I collapse onto the road, holding me, lowering me slowly to the ground. It's over. It's all over. Chapter 35. Nora. The voice is gentle but insistent, tangling in my confused, restless sleep like a hook, dragging me back to reality. I know the voice. Who is it? Not Nina. It's too low for Nina. Nora, the voice says again. I open my eyes. It's Lamar. She is sitting on the chair at the edge of my bed, her dark eyes wide and bright, her shiny hair smoothed back from her sculpted forehead. How are you feeling? I struggle up against the covers and notice that she's wearing a neck brace, incongruous against her silk tunic. I came past yesterday, she says, but they shooed me away. Are you in the hospital too? I croak. She passes me water and I gulp it gratefully. She shakes her head, her heavy gold earrings swaying gently. No. Walking wounded. I got sent home from casualty yesterday morning. Good thing, really, my kids hate me being away overnight. The littlest one is only 4. She has children. This information feels like a peace offering. Something in our relationship has changed. Am I? I manage, and then swallow and start again. Is it over?
You're okay,
Lamar says, if that's what you mean. And as for the case, we're not looking for anyone other than Claire in connection with James's death.
House flow?
I'm not sure if I imagine it, but it feels like a shadow flits across Lamar's face. I can't put my finger on what changes. Her expression is as smooth and calm as before, but there's suddenly a presence in the little room, a dread.
She's holding on,
Lamar says at last.
Can I see her?
Lamar shakes her head.
She's with her family. The doctors aren't permitting any visitors right now.
Have you seen her?
Yesterday, yes.
So she's worse today?
I didn't say that,
Lamar says, but her eyes are troubled. I know what she is not saying. I know what she's skirting round. I remember Nina's words about paracetamol overdoses, and I know that the destructive ripples from Claire's actions have not yet stopped, even now. Of everything Claire did, I think that was the cruelest. What she did to James, what she tried to do to me, at least she had a reason. But Flo, Flo's only crime was loving Claire. I don't know when Flo began to realize the truth, when she started to put two and two together about the text Claire asked her to send from my phone when I arrived at the house. It was innocent enough. James, it's me, Leo Shaw. I don't know what Claire told her. Something silly, I expect. A hen night prank. The first inklings were probably when Nina spilled the beans about my past with James. Perhaps she began to wonder why Claire, of all people, would want to stir things up again. Then, when Lamar started asking questions about phones and texts, she must have realized that something was wrong. I don't suppose she guessed the truth, or not at first. She tried to see Claire in the hospital, but they wouldn't let her. Claire was too ill, and the police weren't keen on the witnesses at the B&B visiting the hospital anyway. Nina said she'd had to fight like a tiger to see me, and then only after they'd gone over her statement 100 times. And Claire at that stage was still feigning confusion and semi-consciousness, waiting to see what transpired with me and Lamar, I suppose, before waking up. No. Flo stayed at the B&B, fretting and wondering and unable to ask Claire about what to say. She lied. She tripped herself up in her lies. She wondered what she'd done, what she'd set in motion. She started to doubt Claire's motives. She got desperate.
Do you know?
I asked, swallowing hard, trying to push away the thoughts of Flo lying somewhere up the corridor, struggling for life.
Do you know what happened? Did Claire tell you?
Claire's too ill to answer questions,
Lamar says grimly.
At least that's what her lawyer says. But we've got enough to piece the case together. Between what you told us, the tox report on the drugs Claire gave you, and, most importantly, Flo's statement, we've got enough. She never did phone the ambulance, you know.
What do you mean?
From the house, when James died. There was no record of her ever trying 999. That should have tipped us off, but we were too busy looking elsewhere.
She sighs.
We'll need to take a formal statement, of course, when you're well enough, but we can worry about that another day.
I thought it was Flo,
I say at last.
When I found Claire's jacket with the shell in it, I thought it was Flo's jacket. I thought she'd changed the shells. I just couldn't work out why Claire would do such a thing. She finally had what she wanted, the perfect life, the perfect fiancé. Why would she throw that all away? It was only when I thought about the text, really thought about it, I realized. James never called me Lee. She didn't make that mistake twice, but I should have realized.
She did it before, you know,
Lamar says.
Her rich voice is like a soft, warm blanket around the coldness of her words. Or a variant. It took us a while to dig it up, but there was a professor at her university. He was sacked for sending inappropriate emails to undergraduates, implying that they would get better grades if they slept with him, and that there might be penalties if they told anyone. He denied it throughout, but there was no doubt that the students did receive the emails, and when his machine was raided, they were there in the deleted folder, all of them, although he'd made a clumsy attempt to destroy them. It seems pretty clear now that Claire was involved, although at the time no one ever suspected her. She wasn't one of the students he was emailing, but a few weeks before he had raised concerns with her that one of her papers was plagiarized, threatened to take it further. Of course, in the ensuing furore, the accusation was forgotten, but one of his colleagues remembered him discussing it. She said she'd always wondered. I shut my eyes, feeling a single tear trace down the line of my nose. I don't know why I'm crying. It's not relief. I don't think it's even grief for James anymore. Maybe it's just fury and frustration at the waste of it all. Anger at myself for not realizing sooner, for being so stupid. And yet, what then, if I had noticed? Would it have been me, lying with my guts splattered across the blonde wood and the frosted glass? I'll leave you, Lamar says softly, and she gets up, the plastic leather of the chair creaking. I'll come back tomorrow with a colleague. We'll take your formal statement, if you're up to it. I don't speak. I only nod, with my eyes still tight shut. After she's gone, there is silence, broken only by a soap theme tune filtering through the wall. I sit and listen to it, and to the breaths I draw in and out of my nose. And then, into the middle of the calm, there's a knock at the door. I open my eyes at once, assuming it's Lamar come back, but it's not. There's a man outside. For a second, my heart flip-flops, and then I realize it's Tom. Knock, knock, he says, putting his head around the door. Come in, I say. My voice is croaky. He shuffles inside. His expression is diffident, unsure of his welcome. He looks pale and far from the groomed urbanisto I'd met just a few days before. His checked shirt is crumpled and has some kind of stain on it. But I can tell from his expression that I must look even worse myself. The black eyes are fading to yellow and brown, but they're still shocking if you haven't seen them. Hi, Tom, I say. I pull the hospital gown up where it slipped down my shoulder, and he smiles, the stiff, frozen smile of someone whose social graces have temporarily deserted them.
Look, I have to get this off my chest, he blurts at last. I thought it was you. I mean, there was all that stuff about your past with James, and then when the police started on about your phone and the texts, I just assumed...
He trails off.
I'm very sorry.
It's okay, I say. I gesture to the chair beside the bed. Look, sit down. Don't worry about it. The police thought it was me too, and they weren't even there.
I'm so sorry,
he repeats with a crack in his voice as he sits awkwardly, hugging his knees.
I never thought...
He stops and then sighs.
Do you know, Bruce never liked her. He loved James. I mean, really loved him, even though they had their ups and downs. But he never had much time for Claire. When I rang him last night and told him everything that's happened, he said, I'm shocked, but I'm not surprised. She never stopped acting, that girl.
We sit in silence for a while as I ponder Bruce's words, the judgment of a man I've never met on one of my oldest friends. And I realize he's right. Claire never stopped acting. Even as a small child, she was acting a part, the part of a good friend, the part of the perfect student, the ideal daughter, the glamorous girlfriend. And I realize, suddenly, that perhaps that's why I found it so hard to reconcile the Claire I knew with these other people, because she was a different person to each of us.
What will happen to her, I wonder? Will a jury convict anyone so charming, so kind, so very, very beautiful? I wonder, I say, and then stop.
What?
Tom asks. I keep thinking, what if I hadn't said yes? To the hen night, I mean. I so nearly didn't come.
I don't know,
Tom says slowly.
Nina and I were talking about the same thing last night. The way I see it, you weren't the point of all this. The point was James. You were just the icing on the cake.
So you mean...
I'm silent, working it out, and he nods.
I think if you hadn't been there, it would have been one of us instead.
It would have been Flo, I say sadly. She sent the text, after all.
Tom nods.
It wouldn't have been hard for Claire to twist the truth a bit, start saying she was afraid of Flo, that Flo was jealous of James, acting irrationally. The worst thing is, we'd probably have backed her up.
Have you seen Flo? I ask.
I tried, he says. They aren't letting anyone in. I think... I'm not sure.
He trails off. We both know what he's not saying.
I'm going back to London tonight, he says at last. But it would be great to keep in touch.
He fishes in his wallet and pulls out a thick, glossy card embossed with Tom Domer and his mobile and email.
I'm sorry, I say. I don't have a card, but if you've got a pen...
He holds out his phone and I type my email address into it and watch while he sends me a blank email.
There,
he says at last, standing up.
Well, I'd better get on the road. Take care of yourself, Shaw.
I will.
How are you getting back to London?
I don't know.
I do, says a voice from the door. I turn, and there is Nina, lounging in the doorframe, an unlit cigarette between her lips. She speaks around it, like a dime store detective.
She's coming with me.
Chapter 36. Home. Such a small word. And yet, when I close the door of my tiny flat behind me and lock the door, I feel a spreading flood of relief that seems too huge to be encompassed by those four letters. I am home. I am home. Jess drove us back. She came all the way up from London to pick up me and Nina and take us home. When they got to my road, they offered to come in, help me carry my case up the three flights of stairs, but I said no.
I'm looking forward to being alone, I said. And it was true. And I knew that they were looking forward to being alone, too. Alone together.
I'd seen the quiet, affectionate gestures on the long drive, Nina's hand resting in Jess's lap, Jess rubbing Nina's knee as she changed gear. But I didn't feel excluded. It wasn't that. I just never knew how much I loved my own space until now.
Flo died a few hours after I saw Tom. 3 days after she'd taken the overdose. Nina was right about that. And right, too, that she'd changed her mind by the end. I never saw her, but Nina visited her and listened while she cried and talked and planned for the future and what she'd do when she left hospital. Her parents were with her when she died. I don't know if it was peaceful. Nina wouldn't tell me, which makes me think not.
I sigh and let my case fall to the floor. I am tired and parched and stiff from the long drive. I open up the coffee maker, pour in the water, and fold the filter paper just so. Then I open up my glass coffee jar and sniff the grounds. They're a week old, but still fresh enough to make the inside of my nose sing. The sound the machine makes as it percolates is the sound of home, and the scent of the steaming grounds is the smell of home. And then at last... I curl my battered body on the bed, my still-packed case on the rug, and I take a long, slow sip. The winter sun is filtering through the rattan blinds, and the traffic below makes a soft roar,
too far away to disturb, more like the sound of the sea on a shore. I think of that glass house, far away, in the stillness of the forest, with the birds swooping past and the woodland animals padding quietly through the garden. I think of its blank glass walls, reflecting the dark shapes of the trees and the moonlight filtering through. Flo's aunt is selling, apparently. Flo's parents told Nina. Too much blood spilt. Too many memories. And she said she was planning to burn the planchette when the police released it. That's the one part I don't understand. The séance. Everything else was necessary. Everything else was part of the plan. But the Ouija board? And that creepy, creepy message? I can still see it now, looping and scrolling across the page. Murderer. Lamar thought it was all deliberate, all part of the plan to unnerve everyone, get them sufficiently on edge so that when the back door swung open, we'd be more inclined to panic and react to a suggestion to get out the gun. But I'm not so sure. I think again about what Tom said, about the messages that float up from the subconscious. Was it Claire's unwilling hand, spelling out what she was so desperately trying to suppress? I shut my eyes, trying to block the memory of that night. But there is no way of shutting it out completely. Flo is gone, but the rest of us, Tom, Nina and I, will have to live with what happened, with what Claire did, with what we all did, for the rest of our lives. My case is on the floor, and I open it up and pull out my laptop. The police still have my phone, but at least I can check my emails. It's more than a week since I left London, and as I fire it up, a message flickers. Downloading one of 187 emails. I sit and watch as they drop one by one into my inbox. There's an email from my editor, and another, two from my agent, one from my mum, headed, "Are you okay?" Then, last of all, come the emails from my website address, "Hot Thai Babes, one weird tip to melt belly fat. You have three comments waiting your approval." And in amongst the spam, "From Matt Ridout, subject, coffee." I feel in my pocket for the curling piece of cardboard, torn off a paper cup. It's nearly unreadable now, his number. The biro is blurring into nothing, and there's a crease across the middle two digits. But I think I can make out that they're both sevens, or possibly ones. I was going to let fate decide, if I got my phone back from the police before the number disappeared. And now this. I remember the way he buried his face in his hands as he cried over James. I remember his smile. I remember the expression in his eyes as he said goodbye. I'm not sure I can do this. I'm not sure I can let go of everything that happened, start again. For a minute, my finger hovers irrationally over the delete button. And then I click.
In a Dark, Dark Wood was written by Ruth Ware and read by Imogen Church. This performance was recorded by Isis Publishing Limited, Oxford, England. Terry Hogan was the mix engineer. The supervising producer was Michael Noble. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. In a Dark, Dark Wood is available in print from Scout Press.
What follows is a preview of Ruth Ware's The Lying Game, read by Imogen Church.
The reach is wide and quiet this morning.
the pale blue sky streaked with pink mackerel belly clouds, the shallow sea barely rippling in the slight breeze. And so the sound of the dog barking breaks into the calm like gunshots, setting flocks of gulls crying and wheeling in the air. Plovers and terns explode up as the dog bounds joyously down the riverbank, scampering down the runnelled side where the earth turns from spiky grassy dunes to reed-specked mud, where the water wavers between salt and fresh. In the distance, the tide mill stands sentinel, black and battered against the cool calm of the morning sky, the only man-made structure in a landscape slowly crumbling back into the sea. "Bob!" The woman's voice rings out above the volley of barks as she pants to catch up. "Bob, you rascal! Drop it! Drop it, I say! What have you found?" As she draws closer, the dog tugs again at the object protruding from the mud, trying to pull it free. "Bob, you filthy brute, you're covered! Let it go!" "Oh, God, it's not another dead sheep, is it?" It's the last heroic yank that sends the dog staggering back along the shore, something in its jaw. Triumphant, he scrambles up the bank to lay the object at the feet of his owner. And as she stands, looking dumbstruck, the dog panting at her feet, the silence returns to the bay, like a tide coming in. Rule 1. Tell a lie. The sound is just an ordinary text alert, a quiet beep-beep in the night that does not wake Owen, and would not have woken me, except that I was already awake, lying there, staring into the darkness, the baby at my breast, snuffling, not quite feeding, not quite unlatching. I lie there for a moment, thinking about the text, wondering who it could be. Who'd be texting at this hour? None of my friends would be awake. Unless it's Millie gone into labour already. God, it can't be Millie, can it? I'd promised to take Noah if Millie's parents couldn't get up from Devon in time to look after him, but I never really thought... I can't quite reach a phone from where I'm lying, and at last I unlatch Freya with a finger in the corner of her mouth and rock her gently onto her back, milk-sated, her eyes rolling back in her head like someone stoned. I watch her for a moment, my palm resting lightly on her firm little body, feeling the thrum of her heart in the birdcage of her chest as she settles. And then I turn to check my phone, my own heart quickening slightly, like a faint echo of my daughter's. As I tap in my PIN, squinting slightly at the brightness of the screen, I tell myself to stop being silly. It's 4 weeks until Millie's due, it's probably just a spam text. "Have you considered claiming a refund for your payment protection insurance?" But when I get the phone unlocked, it's not Millie, and the text is only 3 words. "I need you." It is 3:30 a.m., and I am very, very awake, pacing the cold kitchen floor, biting at my fingernails to try and quell the longing for a cigarette. I haven't touched one for nearly 10 years, but the need for one ambushes me at odd moments of stress and fear. "I need you." I don't need to ask what it means, because I know, just as I know who sent it, even though it's from a number I don't recognize. Kate. Kate Attigan. Just the sound of her name brings her back to me, like a vivid rush. The smell of her soap, the freckles across the bridge of her nose, cinnamon against olive. Kate, Fatima, Fia, and me. I close my eyes and picture them all, the phone still warm in my pocket, waiting for the texts to come through. Fatima will be lying asleep beside Ali, curled into his spine. Her reply will come around 6 a.m. when she gets up to make breakfast for Nadia and Samir and get them ready for school. Thea is harder to picture. If she's working night, she'll be in the casino, where phones are forbidden to staff, and shut up in lockers until their shifts are finished. She'll roll off shift at 8 in the morning, perhaps? Then she'll have a drink with the other girls, and then she'll reply, wired up with a successful night dealing with punters, collating chips, watching for card sharps and professional gamblers. And Kate? Kate must be awake. She sent the text, after all. She'll be sitting at her dad's work table. Hers, now, I suppose, in the window overlooking the reach, with the waters turning pale grey in the pre-dawn light, reflecting the clouds and the dark hulk of the tide mill. She will be smoking, as she always did. Her eyes will be on the tides, the endlessly shifting, eddying tides, on the view that never changes and yet is never the same from one moment to the next, just like Kate herself. Her long hair will be drawn back from her face, showing her fine bones and the lines that 32 years of wind and sea have etched at the corners of her eyes. Her fingers will be stained with oil paint, ground into the cuticles, deep beneath the nails, and her eyes will be at their darkest slate blue, deep and unfathomable. She will be waiting for our replies. But she knows what we'll say, what we've always said, whenever we've got that text, those three words. I'm coming. I'm coming. I'm coming.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.